You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 20th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, first the intention, then the detail. The real work resumes to find a way towards a ceasefire in Gaza. We'll have the latest. Also ahead, after 100 days in power, Argentina's president may be on the way to rescuing the budget, but thousands are protesting against cuts needed to make it happen. We'll examine the human cost of economic recovery. Plus, Joe Biden heads to Nevada, to Arizona and to Texas.
We're the only nation in the world that's come out of every crisis stronger than we went in, every time, when we work together. And with your help, we're going to get people working together in a way they haven't for decades.
And today's papers, I'm delighted to say, are reviewed by Simon Brook. Good morning. What have you
found? Good morning. Well, the FT is looking at whether Europe needs its own version of Israel's Iron Dome. Bloomberg reports on the effect on business of Hong Kong's new security laws. And the Times asks, do real men wear cardigans?
They do, by the way. They do, all of them. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. Just a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. A controversial Texan law that would allow state enforcement authorities to arrest people suspected of illegally crossing the US-Mexico border has been blocked by an appeals court just hours after the US Supreme Court ruled it could take effect. France's defence ministry has accused the chief of Russia's foreign intelligence service of spreading disinformation after he suggested Paris was preparing to send 2,000 troops to Ukraine. And Saudi Arabia's government plans to create a fund of about $40 billion to invest in artificial intelligence. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has given one of his bleakest assessments yet of the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. He said the entire population is at risk because of a lack of supplies of food. A UN-backed report yesterday suggested famine was imminent in the north of Gaza without more aid. Meanwhile, Qatar, which is mediating between Israel and Hamas, says it is cautiously optimistic about a peace deal. Well, I'm joined now by Hannah McCarthy, journalist in Jerusalem and a regular voice here on Monocle Radio. Very good morning to you, Hannah.
Good morning.
So let's just recap a little bit about where we are in terms of the context of the humanitarian crisis. In the last 24 hours, we've had the US Secretary of State effectively saying that this is unheard of, that 100% of people in Gaza are now at risk of starvation.
Sure. So, I mean, it's an incredibly stark statement from an ally of Israel who has supported its right to defend itself since the beginning of the war. It's certainly going to increase pressure on Israel to come to an agreement in these negotiations with Hamas at Qatar, which began at the beginning of this week. One of the kind of sticking points is the movement of aid, particularly up into northern Gaza. In recent days, the UN has been able to get some aid up to the north. I spoke to someone just yesterday who said they've been able to get fuel to water wells. They've been able to deliver some food, but it's just a desperate situation. And again, it's certainly looking extremely bad for the US in an election year to be supporting this kind of, you know, policy and this kind of blockade of aid into northern Gaza.
Indeed. I mean, he not only talked about Israel's need to allow deliveries to go through, but he also called on Hamas to lay down arms and release hostages, something which has been the lines that have been used throughout since the 7th of October. But how much do his words push things along? Because the US is, as you say, such a key military backer of Israel, but it seems to be really lacking leverage now.
Exactly. And again, the fact that the US is going ahead with building a pier because it cannot get Israel to allow enough trucks, which is the only way to get, you know, large scale amounts of aid into Gaza through, you know, the border crossings between Gaza and Israel. So again, there is obviously, you know, influence that the US has over Israel. But given that what we see from Netanyahu is a real reluctance to agree to a truce on the basis that it could create, you know, if there's a 2-month truce in Israel, does that lay the groundwork for calls for an election later this year, which he does not want? So there are real divisions within the Israeli government, which makes it hard to know how, you know, this kind of rhetoric from the US plays. And what we're seeing is quite insular statements from some members of the cabinet who don't seem to care about, you know, the international perspective on this.
Indeed. I mean, we have Israel sending the head of the intelligence agency, Mossad, to discuss this truce to Qatar, plus the release of Palestinian prisoners. Whereas at the same time, Benjamin Netanyahu is still insisting that he will push ahead with plans for a military operation in the south of the country, in the south of the Gaza Strip, I should say.
Yes, and again, it's creating a real issue about, you know, what the actual aims of the Israeli government are in these negotiations. So, you know, the broad parameters of this truce have been agreed, and they've kind of haven't really changed since, you know, even the last truce. So this idea of, you know, Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners, you know, a truce and a kind of cessation in the fighting to allow, you know, larger amounts of aid to get into areas of Gaza that need it. You know, that are the broad parameters of the truce. And the fact that this isn't being agreed means that there are divisions both within Hamas that view it as important to hold on to these hostages as leverage, but also within the Israeli government.
So yesterday, the Qatari foreign minister, who's around the table trying to bring about some sort of ceasefire, said that the two sides were far apart. He says, we cannot say that we are close to a deal. Just explaining in sort of really clear terms what the major sticking points are, because there is a fundamental huge chasm of mistrust between the two sides.
Sure. So the broad parameters of the truce are that there are 40 Israeli hostages, women, children and elderly would be exchanged for several hundred Palestinian prisoners and a 6-week truce. Hamas is no longer demanding a permanent ceasefire and a complete withdrawal of Israeli forces, you know, from the beginning of the deal, but would like there to be a basis for a permanent ceasefire after. The sticking points are the number of Palestinian prisoners and, you know, how, you know, senior or they are, or, you know, the severity of the crimes which they've committed. And also, if these types of prisoners are released, are they exiled from the West Bank or Israel or Gaza, or are they allowed to return to their homes? There's also a sticking point about the level of aid that's going into Gaza and also the return of Palestinians who are displaced in Rafah to the northern Gaza Strip. And again, this is a kind of complicated point, and it feeds into the proposals for a Rafah operation, which is also kind of complicating this negotiations in the sense, if Palestinians are allowed to return to their homes in northern Gaza, does this, you know, clear the way for an operation in Rafah? At the same time, if they are not, you know, provided somewhere else to go, there is no feasible way for the US or for Israel to go into Rafah. So there's a lot of different kind of strategies going on in these negotiations.
Tell us a little bit more, therefore, about why the Qatari foreign minister, having said that the two sides were far apart, having said that they're not close to a deal, but he then added, we are cautiously optimistic.
Again, you know, we've heard cautious optimism many times before. You know, I mean, people might remember that video clip of, you know, Joe Biden eating an ice cream and saying, you know, he expected a deal by Monday. And again, what we're seeing in this conflict is a lot of statements that are designed to, you know, put pressure or to create one face that might not necessarily, you know, betray what's actually happening in the negotiations. Certainly, there is pressure on both sides internationally to agree a deal, but there are certainly factions within both Hamas and the Israeli government that are going to, you know, see it as their interest to hold on to hostages or to not, you know, agree a deal. So it's definitely a complicated process, and I think people, and it should take about 2 weeks, but I think people, you know, I think cautious optimism is definitely the only way you could describe the mood around these negotiations.
We began this this segment talking about Antony Blinken laying out this dreadful warning about the catastrophic state of the catastrophic humanitarian state in Gaza. Let's go back to his next job, which is he's in the Middle East to go to Saudi Arabia and also go to Egypt to do what? To firstly try and get this ceasefire over the line, but also to talk more about the longer term situation in the region, talking about a post-war plan.
Sure. So, I mean, we've heard various proposals suggested about what, you know, what the ruling structure or the governing structure of Gaza should be, you know, when there is an end to the war. Israel has said, you know, has said it should be reoccupying the Gaza Strip, and also that it should be using, you know, local, what it describes as local clans and local families to rule the Gaza Strip, and what many aid agencies have said are basically, you know, gangs in some respects, and some of the groups that are actually, you know, looting or taking control of some of the aid that's going into the Gaza Strip. That has got an extremely cold response from the international community, who believe, you know, the only option is a, you know, what they're describing as a revitalized Palestinian Authority in the Gaza Strip. They say Hamas should have, you know, no role in that. There are analysts who criticize that on the basis that, you know, Hamas does have, you know, a degree of popular support in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank. And if a government doesn't represent, you know, some sort of element of that group, it may not have popular support. There's also discussions among Palestinian groups, including the Palestinian Liberation Organization, about whether Hamas can be incorporated into that movement if it gives up its, you know, vows of armed struggle against Israel. Again, a lot going on behind the scenes about that.
Indeed. I mean, and how willing do you think Israel would be to accept any of these ideas that are being put forward for this post-war plan? There is very much a sense that they would resist anything along those lines. But nonetheless, we have Antony Blinken going around and trying to gather international support to put pressure on the proposal for a post-war peace plan. How is that going to work?
Again, we are seeing, you know, some countries move towards, you know, reducing arms sales to Israel, which will certainly increase pressure on Israel to come to, you know, a resolution that the international community has a bit of support for. But at the same time, I mean, the US isn't, you know, announcing that it's about to pause, you know, arms or military aid support to Israel. So, and again, this is not the first time Antony Blinken has been in the Middle East. He has been here more than any other U.S. Secretary of State. So, you know, it's hard to know where the U.S. are going with their strategy. It hasn't worked so far. But again, you know, in these kind of conflicts, we don't always know what the turning point is. We know that the U.S. or the Israeli government has stuck very hard to its red lines and relatively successfully. You know, it has not had to increase aid across the land crossings. And as a result, you know, the U.S. is building a pier. So, I mean, Antony Blinken is not going into these negotiations necessarily as someone who has, you know, provided, you know, a kind of firm view to Israel on what the policy should be.
Hannah McCarthy, thank you as ever for joining us on The Globalist. You're listening to Monocle Radio. It's 7:13 a.m. here in London, 4:13 a.m. in Buenos Aires, and there have been more protests in Argentina against the president, Javier Milei, in a power for, 100 days. A new libertarian leader and his government have faced demonstrations over cuts to social services and to subsidies. Well, I'm joined now by Andrew Thompson, who's a journalist and political risk analyst specialising in Latin America. Welcome back, Andrew.
Good morning.
Good to have you on the programme. Just tell us a little bit about these protests. They have been intense and they have been widespread, haven't they?
There have been a number of protests. Perhaps the most outstanding was a general strike held in January, which is only about a month after the new president took office. It has to be said that the protests... Argentina seeing a lot more intense protests in the past, so in some ways they're not really causing major problems for the government at this stage, which feels that a significant portion of public opinion is still supporting the current president's call for austerity and economic reform.
Tell us a little bit about the nature of their protests. And you say they're not quite as intense as they possibly have been in the past. Nonetheless, they are taking to the streets. Riot police are being deployed to deal with them. But the reasons for their protests are what?
Well, I suppose the most important thing is that there is a new president, far-right president, And he is making major, major changes to the economy. Essentially, he's saying that government spending has been way too high for too many years. It's been funded through a gaping fiscal deficit, and all this has got to change. And first indications are that he is having some economic success. The deficit in the first 2 months of this year disappeared, and he's kind of getting approval from international financial markets. Argentine bonds are gaining in price and yield. So it's in that sense, it's looking good for him. But if you analyze, if you go beyond those headlines, it turns out that the adjustment in the fiscal deficit, the elimination of the deficit, was based on allowing a 40% decrease in state pensions. So that's an absolutely massive cut in the income of Argentina's elderly population. It was also achieved by almost stopping all transfers to the provinces, and there is now an ongoing battle between the president and the provincial governors over how tax revenue should be divided. So the question has got to be, is this approach to austerity sustainable, really? Or will the protests that, as you say, exist and continue, will they gather pace? Just to give one example, Argentina is traditionally quite a wealthy society compared to others in Latin America, but the in a matter of perhaps 12 months, the poverty rate has increased and is now at 57.8% of the population. So although the president has his supporters, he's getting something like a 50% approval rating. He won the elections with 56%, so there's a certain reduction in his support going on. Despite that support, you have to ask, will this lead to some kind of social explosion, as various other Latin American countries have seen in recent years?
And there are plenty of pictures that suggest that those who are suffering at the hands of these cuts are really suffering, that food banks are becoming overwhelmed, and indeed, as you mentioned, that the state pension cut has severely affected a large proportion of the elderly population. How much is the Senate and how much are the internal political workings of the Argentinian government allowing Milei to do this? Or are there checks and balances and indeed blocks for his plans?
There are checks and balances, and one of the questions is trying to see how this will evolve over the next few months, which is quite hard. One of the strangest things is that Milei is in a minority in Congress. His official party has only about 10 to 15% of the seats in the Senate and in the lower house. So to get support for his reforms, to push them through, he needs to make alliances with centrists and provincial parties. Yet he is consistently, if you like, insulting his potential allies. Those who voted against some of his proposals, he described them as traitors. He is part of his personal brand, if you like, is to be quite foul-mouthed and angry, and he appeals to Argentine voters who feel angry themselves. But he has said, rather than saying let's work out a deal with the provincial governors, he said, I will urinate on you, and I will, destroy you. Very, very kind of combative language. And yet, at the same time, he's now saying, well, maybe there should be a more collaborative approach to rethinking how provincial funding works. And he's promoting something he's calling the May Pact, which would be May, 25th of May is the Argentina Independence Day. And what he's seeking to do is to get the governors to negotiate a new deal before the 25th of May.
How long do you think that firebrand approach is going to last?
It's hard to say. A lot of people were saying the firebrand approach won him the elections, job done. Now he should become more of a statesman, more of a figure of unity, and creating collaboration across the political spectrum, but he's not done that. And this kind of aggressive persona seems likely to continue. I think you should also mention briefly that he has made some quite serious political mistakes, which so far haven't cost him too dearly, but might in future. Just to give a quick example, it transpired that amidst all these calls for austerity, the presidential salary had actually increased by about 40% between January and February. And he then rather shamefacedly said, this had not been intended. He'd signed a decree for a general increase in salaries, and he hadn't realized it was also increasing his salary, because his whole, if you like, political argument is that most Argentine politicians are corrupt and he is not. When it turns out that you're feathering your own salary, it's a bit hard to defend politically.
Andrew Thompson, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. Still to come on today's programme, the US President Joe Biden attempts to secure his standing in Nevada and Arizona in this all-important election year.
We're the only nation in the world that's come out of every crisis stronger than we went in, every time, when we work together. And with your help, we're going to get people working together in a way they haven't for decades.
Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
/7:22 here in London. Let's have a look at today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Simon Brook, journalist and communications consultant. Good morning, Simon. How are you?
Good morning. Very well, thanks. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And looking forward to plunging into some pretty useful and interesting stories this morning. You want to begin with a story in the FT, which is, it's a call that's been put out by, I think it's the biggest munitions manufacturer in the European Union, Rheinmetall. They have suggested, or rather the company's CEO has suggested, that the European Union, or Europe, needs an iron dome like Israel.
Yeah, that's right. So the chief executive, Armin Papager, says that a short-range air defence system was something they want to create in Europe. And the report, the FT reports that the idea has been dismissed as being far-fetched by some analysts, but it points out that EU countries have invested in an array of air defence technology. Mr. Papinger himself points to the European Sky Shield initiative, and this was launched back in 2022 by German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. And just so you know, it's basically a project to build a sort of ground-based integrated European air defence system, which includes anti-ballistic missile capabilities. And so far, 19 European states participate, and Greece and Turkey are expected to formally join this year. And obviously the FT points out, you know, given Putin's election, in inverted commas, election victory at the weekend, this comes about as EU capitals are boosting military spending amid this increased fear about Russia's threat. So the FT reports that another European defence executive has said that Europe is ready. All the capabilities in order to create the full layers of defence are there. So it's just a matter of deciding whether or not to use it. And there's also a quote from another defence manufacturer, Roberto Cingolani, who is chief executive of Leonardo, which is a Rome-based aerospace group. He tells the FT that everybody is talking to everybody. So a real sense that there might be some momentum here.
Indeed. Yet at the same time, it highlights the fundamental issues which run through Europe's ability to react to anything every single time. Obviously, it has Ukraine at the heart of this argument. Yet the fact remains is it opens up that big debate as how unified should any military system or any response be from the European Union as a whole? And yet it also highlights the perpetual problem, or rather recent perpetual problem, that France and Germany are not getting on, or rather Olaf Scholz and Emmanuel Macron aren't getting on. And the fact that that Olaf Scholz and his announcement of, what was it, the European Sky Shield initiative, led to lots of people signing up, apart from France, who said that it was strategically muddled and ill-conceived. So you have the usual problems emerging from a new issue, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And obviously there was Emmanuel Macron's suggestion that there should be boots on the ground from the EU, which was roundly slapped down by Mr. Scholz and other European leaders. So I think there's two things here. One is this lack of coordination between European states, and the other is the amount of time it takes to get these things organised. So the FT again reminds us that the EU's defence strategy calls for capabilities related to integrated European air and defence, missile defence, by 2035. That's 11 years away. Meanwhile, Russia is on manoeuvres. So coordination, but also timing, is very much of the essence.
Yes, 11 years away suddenly doesn't seem like a very long time.
Not at all.
Your face has just said you agree with that. Let's have a look at a story from Bloomberg. Hong Kong's new security bill triggers warnings from overseas. We dealt with this yesterday on The Globalist, with the fact that this was a furthering of legislation to effectively curb human rights in Hong Kong. The reaction from overseas has been obviously the condemnation of what's going to happen to Hong Kongers, but it does now make doing business in Hong Kong, if you are a foreign company, much, much harder.
Yeah, exactly. So Bloomberg points out that this new legislation is passed, as it says, just as officials try to burnish the city's reputation as a finance hub and tourist destination. And this was dented by years of strict COVID curbs and a crackdown on dissent, and as you say, criticism from the Biden administration, from the EU, and Bloomberg points out that there is a sort of parallel here. We've seen comparing the chilling effect of China's increasingly draconian anti-freedom laws on business and foreign investment. And Bloomberg points out that China's vague espionage legislation, which has spooked foreign investors over the past year, has also had this effect. So what has not worked for China, they're now imposing on Hong Kong, and it doesn't look like it's going to be very successful there. Just one little statistic which did amuse me in the Bloomberg report here. The Hong Kong Security Secretary, Chris Tang, has said that this legislation, Article 23, has widespread support locally, with 98.6% of public feedback being positive or constructive in nature. I mean, that's kind of, again, Putin-esque sort of statistics, isn't it? I cannot believe that, but there you go.
Funny that.
Yeah.
An excellent opinion piece in the New York Times you wanted to bring our attention to by Thomas L. Friedman. The headline is What Schumer and Biden Got Right About Netanyahu. And he starts off with an incredibly good analogy. He says, one of the ironclad rules of journalism is this: when you see an elephant flying, don't laugh, don't doubt, don't sneer, take notes. And he said that seeing the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, an authentic, lifelong backer of Israel, say that they need to get rid of Benjamin Netanyahu and start and elect a new leader was one of those moments. Mm,
absolutely. So Friedman asks, what has gone so haywire with the US-Netanyahu relationship that it would drive somebody as sincerely devoted to Israel's well-being as Chuck Schumer call on Israelis to replace Netanyahu? And the answer to his question actually is Netanyahu. He points out that America's entire Middle East strategy right now depends on Israel partnering with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and non-Hamas Palestinians to create this two-state solution. And this is, of course, something that Netanyahu has expressly ruled out, along with any other fully formed plan for the morning after Gaza. Israel is not going to defeat Hamas in Gaza. And Friedman points out that in previous wars have been about just retaliation, but this is an attempt to completely destroy Hamas. The other thing he points out, I think, is in terms of international reaction to the situation in Gaza, I think is very important. It sounds trivial, but he says that this is the first of these major conflicts which has been fought in an age of TikTok. And I think this is really important. He says 15-second videos of the worst human suffering beamed out constantly. And if you want to know why we're having so many demonstrations in European capitals, these videos are one of the reasons.
It's an amazing article. It ranges far and wide. It's worth a good sit down and a read, actually. Right, finally, you mentioned this at the beginning of the programme, and the love of cardigans among both men, women and everybody became a sudden topic of hot debate in the control room
in
the studio. This is an article in The Times which seems to have struck a lot of fundamental chords here. Real men wear cardigans and they still suit women too. Why is this a thing, Simon?
Well, this is a thing because Harriet Walker, the Times of London fashion correspondent, notes that the Prince of Wales, Prince William, wore a navy cardigan with a shirt collar and two patch pockets when he visited a youth club in West London last week. And fashion luminaries as David Beckham, Andrew Scott, Ryan Reynolds, Paul Mescal have been seen wearing cardigans. Apparently Ryan Reynolds, if you want to know, wore a 1,300 two-pocket cashmere cardigan by Bruno Cucinelli on the David Letterman show. And as a result, the cardigan sold out immediately. I'm not wearing one today, but I'm a huge fan of cardigans. They're just brilliant.
What is it about a cardigan that you love so much?
I love it because it's so versatile. You can go for something sheer and smart like Prince William's, or you can go for something chunky, even though I like chunky. But apparently, according to Harriet Walker here in The Times, chunky is out. Think Swedish architect over Norwegian fisherman, she says. Well, I'm backing Norwegian fishermen
all the way. One wonders though why this is a thing when anybody thought that real men didn't wear cardigans.
Well, that's a really good question. I suppose what it is, a certain type of man, isn't it? The sort of, I've almost given up on fashion, I'm going to sit here and shout at the telly sort of bloke would still be wearing cardigans. But as I say, the fact they're so versatile, you can, you know, the colour, the cut, shawl collar or not, how many buttons, do you leave the bottom button undone?
It's always.
So much to offer.
Thank you, Simon. We won't go into what it's like being a woman wearing a cardigan. That's another half hour's discussion. But thank you, Simon Brooke, not in a cardigan. Thank you for joining us in the studio. The time is, 7:32 here in London. A look now at the latest news. A controversial Texan law that would allow state enforcement authorities to arrest people suspected of illegally crossing the US-Mexico border has been blocked by an appeals court just hours after the US Supreme Court ruled it could take effect. The so-called SB4 legislation gives local officers powers which traditionally are delegated to federal law enforcers. The Biden administration has challenged SB4, calling it unconstitutional. France's defense ministry has accused the chief of Russia's foreign intelligence service of spreading disinformation after he suggested Paris was preparing to send 2,000 troops to Ukraine. Franco-Russian relations have deteriorated further in recent weeks as Paris has increased its support to Ukraine, including signing a bilateral long-term security accord and promising to send more long-range cruise missiles. Donald Trump has filed a US Supreme Court brief arguing that a former president enjoys absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for his official acts. The case is due to be argued next month. And Saudi Arabia's government plans to create a fund of about $40 billion to invest in artificial intelligence. The New York Times reports that Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund has discussed a potential partnership with a US venture capital firm and other financiers in recent weeks. And those are the headlines on The Globalist. We return now to the US presidential trail. While the headlines are dominated by Donald Trump's courtroom woes, President Joe Biden is quietly getting on with campaigning. He's taking a three-day trip to Nevada, Arizona and Texas, courting the Latino vote. And I'm joined now by Natasha Lindstedt, who's Professor of Government at the University of Essex. Very good morning to you, Natasha. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Just explain to us, Nevada, Arizona and Texas, how close run are these states when it comes to Biden versus Trump?
So with Nevada and Arizona, those really are swing states, and it's hard to know who is going to win. You seen recent polls showing that Biden is not doing very well in those states. Texas has always been a Republican stronghold. There's really no chance of Biden winning the state of Texas. But it's still important to campaign there because it has so many electoral votes in the Electoral College. But I think what these states, why these states are particularly important is because they have a large percentage of Hispanic voters. And this is a demographic that Biden did fairly well with in 2020. He won 63% of the Hispanic vote. But 2022 midterms, you saw Republicans won about 43% of Hispanic voters. So that was a jump. And then these recent polls, including a New York Times poll, but some other polls have shown that Trump is leading Biden with Hispanics by 5 or 6 points. That would be a huge swing. I can't imagine that would actually hold in the election in November. But I think this campaign trip that Biden is taking is trying to really reset his campaign with Hispanic voters, which are an important part of his coalition.
And Biden hasn't held back, has he? And the reports from what he's been doing in Arizona, I think he went into a restaurant, didn't he, in a local Mexican restaurant, and says, "I need you back," because there is a real fear that Trump will take the Latino vote. But the thing that Biden was highlighting was that he very clearly said that it's not just a choice between me and a guy named Trump. He said that Trump actually used quite a lot of derogatory rhetoric towards Latinos, especially when he was talking about people coming over from Mexico. How much does that have any effect on whether the Latino population actually goes for Trump or Biden?
I mean, this is one of the biggest mysteries, is how a candidate, Trump, would basically say that many of the Hispanics that are coming from the South are bringing in, you know, criminals and rapists and so forth. He has said some of the most inflammatory racist things towards Hispanics that you would think that would turn them all off. But that doesn't appear to be enough to get them to vote for Biden. We see that Biden's approval rating is really low amongst Hispanic voters. It's around 36%. And 2/3 of Hispanics just don't think Biden has done much in office. And they tend to prefer Republican candidates on the economy or inflation. That being said, they do say that Democrats care more about them than Republicans do. And they tend to support Democrats on issues of health care and gun control. I would say both parties have neglected Hispanics, have neglected this demographic. And in 2020, about 10% of the electorate was Hispanic, although 15% are eligible. That may not seem like much, but actually when it comes down to the margins of some of these really close races, it's important. So Biden has launched a campaign in both Spanglish and Spanish to try to kickstart things, emphasizing his pro-union roots and so forth. But I think both parties really have neglected this demographic, and it's one that is incredibly important.
Tell us a little bit more about this news that's been breaking in the last few hours about this controversial Texan law, SB4, which was introduced to give local officers the powers to arrest people suspected of illegally crossing the US-Mexico border. About 12, 13 hours ago, the US Supreme Court said that, yes, it can take effect. The Biden administration have said it's unconstitutional. But in the last few hours, a local court has actually put a freeze on it, has banned it again. And this sort of absolutely goes to the heart of where the problems are, doesn't it?
I mean, it definitely does. And we're seeing that the Supreme Court, since Trump handpicked three of the Supreme Court justices, has moved incredibly conservative. So in the past, you would have seen lower courts making decisions that were more conservative, and then the Supreme Court maybe coming in to dispute those or to overrule those. But instead, we're seeing the Supreme Court pretty much siding with Trump and his MAGA movement in many different respects, but particularly with immigration. And of course, Mexico has come back against the Supreme Court ruling that this was completely unacceptable. And then very recently, you see lower courts striking down against this. So it's a real tug of war about what is right and how we interpret the law. But we're seeing immigration is probably one of the most important issues in the upcoming election.
Natasha Linstedt, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. It's 8:39 in Bratislava, 7:39 here in London, and voters in Slovakia go to the polls this weekend. The country's presidential election is being seen as a test for a nation whose leadership, some say, is moving dangerously closer towards Moscow. Well, I'm joined now by Rob Cameron, a journalist in Prague. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning to you.
So just explain to us a little bit about the context of this election. Who are the candidates and what is likely to happen?
Right, well, there are two front-runner candidates. They are Peter Pellegrini. He's a former Prime Minister of Slovakia and now the Chairman of Parliament. And he is a member, or his party is one of the three parties in Robert Fico's populist nationalist coalition that took power in Slovakia back in October after winning the elections in September. So he is very much seen as the government's candidate, despite many of the tensions, not only between him and Mr. Fico, but other members of that government for a variety of reasons, which I'll be happy to go into. And then the other main challenger to him is Ivan Korchok. He is a liberal, pro-Western, former foreign minister. He was in the government, I think, two governments or three governments back. Slovakia's had a lot of governments in the last few years, and he really represents the EU and NATO mainstream in Slovakia, and is very much the hope of the sort of younger liberal population in this small country in Central and Eastern Europe, which has seen a remarkable comeback for a man, Robert Fico, who many people thought was finished in politics.
So do explain these problems to us, because they're not just causing problems inside Slovakia, but quite a lot of Slovakia's neighbours are worried.
They are, yes. I think, and that's because Robert Fico, who was a social democrat leftist way back, but has evolved into pretty much, very patriotic nationalist, always talking about Slovakia's sovereignty and has a sovereign right to choose its own path despite its allegiances and alliances in the EU and NATO. So he's said that Slovakia will reach out to all countries around the world defending a controversial meeting between his foreign minister and the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, in Turkey a few weeks ago. He's spoken out vehemently against military support to Ukraine. He says no one's talking about peace. Why doesn't European countries, instead of arming the Ukrainians, sit down around the negotiating table so that this war can end? Because he says it's the only way for this war to end is via negotiation and not by constantly fueling this conflict in his eyes. And so he's very much taken Slovakia in a completely different direction. It's a screeching U-turn, really, for this country since autumn, because until that point, Slovakia was amongst one of Ukraine's firmest supporters. So obviously concerns about fractures in the West's alliance against in support of Ukraine against Russia as the war plays out, and also concerns about what he'll do at home as well, with attacks on the penal code, the judiciary, and most recently the public media.
Indeed, I mean, the French have excluded Slovakia from follow-up talks about the Ukrainian peace frameworks. You're in Czechia at the moment. The Czech government has suspended government consultations with Slovakia. What does this mean for Slovakia's wider, longer relationship?
It's a really good question, and we're seeing that evolve in real time. And I think the truth is, we just don't know. Robert Fico, in the past, he's a veteran of both Slovak and Slovak politics, and he had various legal roles as well to do with the European Union before that. So Slovakia has always been at the heart of that decision-making process. It's in the Eurozone, uses the Euro, unlike the Czechs, unlike the Hungarians, unlike the Poles. And so now people are asking, well, which direction are you taking this country in? But in the past, he's always proved to be, when it came down to it, extremely pragmatic. So he'll make a lot of noise, especially at home, about defending Slovakia's sovereignty and interests, talking down the European Union and NATO and so on, and making these what seem to be approaches towards Moscow. But when it comes down to actually vetoing perhaps European agreements, he seems to be less keen to do that than perhaps, say, Viktor Orban. And in the end, he does tend to back down. But the question is that going to be the version of Robert Fico we now get? Or is this a much darker and much more pro-Russian, pro-Moscow politician that we're seeing coming to the fore?
So just quickly, finally, this weekend's presidential elections, what influence could they have on the politics that we've just been talking about?
Frankly, not much, because Slovakia is a parliamentary democracy with most power lies in the hands of the government via the parliament. And the president is more of a figurehead. But if you look at the current president, the Liberal Zuzana Čaputová, she succeeded in at least putting the brakes a bit on Robert Fico's attempts to curtail the independence of the Slovak judiciary and change some of the penal code, which has been extremely controversial. She sent some of it. She refused to sign it and sent some of it to the Constitutional Court. So the president does have a slightly breaking, limiting effect on the government in Slovakia. So if Peter Pellegrini, Mr. Fico's reluctant ally, as you were, is elected, then obviously Robert Fico will have free rein to do what he wants. If Ivan Korchok is elected, then perhaps that will make life slightly more uncomfortable, but not impossible for Robert Fico.
Robert Cameron, thank you so much for joining us on the line. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now let's hear from Monocle's design editor, Nick Moniz. He recently met Maxime Danjac, the French architect who has a portfolio including scenography for Hermès and collaborations with the likes of Lanvin and a number of other luxury outlets. Well, he's also been recently appointed the artistic director of the Orient Express, leading a team that is redesigning the train. Maxime joined Nick in the studio to talk about designing for luxury travel, imbued with respect for tradition and detail.
I reinvent the new future train, the new Orient Express, which is a property of the brand Orient Express. And we reinvent with the spirit of the creator of the trademark. We reinvent a modern product who respect forgotten rules, forgotten history. I ask to have time to draw, to redraw, to do mistake, take some time to do some research. What was the real train in 1920? What was an innovation? How can we manage water, sustainability, electricity, sound, for everything? They've got an old train. They rediscover stock between Belarus and Poland.
And you were working on that old train?
And I'm working on that old train.
Still going, ongoing process?
It's complicated because you are working with small artisans and it's an industrial process which is a small scale. But it's really also a market. We have not a lot of luxury train in the world. You are working with people at the scale of a car like Bentley, old Ferrari or old Rolls-Royce than to work with people refitting planes or things like that. It's an old industry with a new kind of product. It's extremely complicated with the integration of the security of the our century and to try to work in a really small width to be able to have a little living room, private toilets, everything to be able to put away your jacket without hurting the wall.
You've kind of got two things going on here. You're working on that history, but then there's also the actual vessel. It's architecture that's in motion, a train, essentially. Maybe we'll start with the history first. How do you start to address the history of the Orient Express brand in your design?
It was easy because the quantity of archive are enormous. In 1926, they've got more than 14,000 plans only for plate, glasses, forks. So each item was drawn and made for the Compagnie des Wagons-Lits. When you have this kind of details everywhere, be able to think about how to serve mustard, what kind of bucket for champagne, because it's going to move, how are you going to fix it on the table. So it's real design. It's not only a nice bucket or a nice bottle. If you don't know how to put it on the table, which is smallest, because you don't have so much room and it's extremely expensive, you cannot succeed. So we go in the same kind of way of thinking and of drawing. Where I come from, I learned to draw with a real small pen, with small line, extremely precise. When I redraw for that project, I use the same kind of technology that they use at the time. After that, we have 3D, we have everything, because it was impossible to build such a product. But it begins with the same kind of way of thinking and of drawing.
So not even drawing just from the archive. You're drawing inspiration from there, but you're literally drawing in the same way that they drew
exactly.
These originals.
Some people, when they saw all my plans, they cannot say the date. It was the only way to do it. Because on a train, if you do a mistake of 8 millimeters, you are going to broke your toes.
So let's talk a little bit about that. There's a lot of complexity to designing for a
train. Not a lot, only complexity.
only
no complexity.
Simplicity.
No, only complexity. Because the width of the room is 1 meter, 96, 8, it depends of the car. And in that, you have to find the way to sleep well. So vibration, size, glamour, because if you make a voyage with your partner, you need to have this glamorous and this sensual emotion. But before that, there is all the building of that. Where are you going to put the pillow, the four pillow? It's complicated in a train. Where are you going to put the big luggage? Do you need to call a butler to use your luggage? No, you need to be able to use it alone. You are going to have a safe. We don't want TV, but we will have Wi-Fi hidden. Do we want to know the time? Do we need the clock? Yes, no. After that, the view is really important in the room. So we try to work on the inside window. We redesign everything, carpet, motif decoration, and we reinvent a kind of plant, because Orient Express invent something really specific, la grande transformation. It was daytime, you have a small tiny room, and you go for dinner. And when you came back, you have your room dressed for the night. So it was two atmosphere. And we say, if they did it at this time, we need to do something now.
So your room has multiple functions.
Yes, we change one thing because the comfort change. For Orient Express and all the luxury train, it was 10 cabins and one toilet, which could be complicated, because if you are going to the toilet at night, you are going to meet a girl in the corridor of 58 centimeters. If we do something, it has to be really comfortable. So in a car of 21 meters long, we do 3 suites. So in each suite, you have your toilets, your big shower. It's more than 80 centimeters of diameter. There are a few apartments in Paris or in London who doesn't got that. The grand transformation was, instead to have a tiny room with a tiny bed and a tiny living room and a super tiny bathroom, we say we need a big bathroom. We need to put the toilet in a specific box, and we need to have a big room who change in room and living room. There is a transformation who make 2 couch in 2 or 1 bed in less than 2 minutes by 1 people. It's extremely technologic. It has to be light, but heavy and not to move during the night. All these items are extremely complicated, but it's real design.
Maxime Donjac there in conversation with Monocle's Nick Moniz. You're listening to The Globalist. Finally on today's programme, let's talk business. Rachel Pupazzoni is national business reporter and presenter at ABC News in Australia. A very good afternoon to you, Rachel.
Hi, Emma. Good to be with you.
So we're going to be hearing from the US Federal Reserve a little bit later. What are we expecting to hear?
No change is expected today, which is quite different if you cast your mind back to sort of the conversation and forecasting that was happening six or fewer months ago, when there was an expectation that the first cut from the US Fed would be at this month's meeting. Now, of course, data changes constantly. And since those sort of projections a few months ago, we've obviously had the latest inflation reading, which came in higher than expected, as well as some other data points. So today, no change is expected, but what people will be looking for is the commentary that we get from Jerome Powell. Last week, he was during his testimony to Capitol Hill, said that while cuts soon are unlikely, the Fed is close. And these are words that analysts and economists really cling to. Any change in language is really important, and that's what we're seeing, expected to see today. Of course, today's numbers also, while they won't change, they will give some projections for the long term as well, and the months ahead, and where the bank thinks inflation will be heading from here on. So while no change is expected, people will be dissecting, I think, pretty much every word that comes out of Jerome Powell's mouth later today.
Indeed. I mean, obviously, in an election year as well, every word counts.
Absolutely. I was speaking to a Bank of America securities analyst just last week about this issue and whether any change in government, if Donald Trump is indeed the returned to the presidency, whether that would change any decision making from the US Fed. And as it is in the US, as it is here in Australia, and no doubt it is in the UK, central banks are very separate from politics. But it's hard to really for onlookers to separate the two, because one must react to the other. Then we're talking about policy as well from different governments and different sides of government. So there's so much weighing into every decision that is made by the US Fed this year ahead of that November election.
Let's head to Japan. It yesterday ended an era of negative interest rates after I think it was, 17 years. What's been the effect 24 hours on?
Yeah, that's right. Leading into the decision yesterday, the market was kind of split as to whether they would make that decision this month or leave it to the next meeting. They indeed went ahead with the decision to end its negative interest rate policy. Just for listeners, the negative rate policy was negative 0.1%, and while they have now moved to neutral and have therefore may become the last sort of country in the world to have negative interest rates, we're not expecting to see drastic change and a drastic uptick. The Nikkei was closed today, their stock exchange, so there really hasn't been much market reaction. But we did see the Japanese yen, their currency, fall to a 4-month low today, 151 yen buying one US dollar, and that comes after it fell 11% against the US dollar last year. Now, the Bank of Japan took confidence in moving to a neutral rate this week after we saw some very big companies raise salaries by more than 5% in the last month or so. And that's really what they've been wanting to see to give them some confidence that there is confidence within the economy and within the consumer as well. So higher wages will mean more spending and ensure that their inflation remains elevated.
Rachel Puppetsoni, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist, and that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to our producers too, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Laura Kramer. Our researcher was George Ruskin and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday here in London, and The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. I hope you can join me for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.